Now, you gathered from the reading we had earlier that this psalm is set, or appears to be set, quite firmly in that particular incident when the children of Israel had all moved up to the border of the promised land. Don't think that the journey from Egypt to the promised land was such a long way away that it took all those years to get there. It was actually a well-travelled route. You think of the incident with Jacob and Joseph, how they went up to the promised land and they went back again to Egypt, and then they had to go back, and there was quite a lot of coming backwards and forwards. It was a well-travelled route. The Lord could have taken them from there to there in a matter of weeks, but it took 40 years. And we are given the reason for that in the narrative that I read from Numbers, that the children of Israel, days after all those remarkable plagues and incidents of the display of the power of God in the most dramatic visual ways possible, the Red Sea parting, allowing them to go through on dry land, pouring them back over the Egyptian chariots, and Pharaoh destroying the Egyptian military in one fell swoop, and their hearts singing for joy, and all of that. You have the provision for them in the desert. There's manna, there is the water that is given, and there is an outbreak of miracles. Staggering, breathtaking miracles. And yet, all of that just seems to get dissipated just in a matter of days. And their hearts fail them. And they go up to the border of the promised land, that land that God has promised to bring them. Right early on, I will bring you from Egypt. He is going to settle them in this land. The God who has begun a good work will bring it to perfection. And yet, right on the borderline, they see some tall people. I mean, they exaggerate it ridiculously, in fact. They weren't all giants. Later on, you read about the Canaanites, and they talk about when the Israelites came up to their border, and they were terrified of them. It was unbelief. Somehow that those experiences have failed them, and they fail to trust God. And there is a minority report of the two men, Joshua and Caleb, and the majority report of the 10 other spies. And the 10 say, well, it's great land, all right. It does flow with milk and honey. It's fertile. But the people, there are so many. They're so big. They're so numerous. We haven't got a chance. We seem like grasshoppers to ourselves and to them. And they persuade the people. If ever there was an indication that democracy is not a perfect system, let's put it that way, then that would be it. The vast, huge majority, all but two men, well, three if you put in Moses and maybe Aaron and Miriam as well, but nonetheless, a handful of people to the great swelling tide of unbelief. And they carry the day, and God turns them back. And God says, you spent 40 days spying out the land. Well, for every day that you spent spying out the land, that's a year. 40 years you'll be in this wilderness until your bodies will fall. You're concerned about the situation. You're concerned about your children. Well, I'll bring your children in, and they will settle in this land. And those children prove to be the most godly generation probably in Israel's history. And God took care of the children they were so worried about. But in anger, they perished. over that course of the 40 years, apart from Joshua and Caleb, who entered the promised land as the two oldest men and the two most godly men. Well, at that point in time, I'd just like us to try and put ourselves in Moses' shoes, how he felt. He was an 80-year-old man. I don't know what our ages are, but it's not that far away, but when you get to 80, and then you understand that there is 40 years in a desert, a hot, searing, energy-sapping desert, going nowhere, what are we going to do? And in Moses' case, it's not my fault. It's not my sin, he could say quite justifiably. Moses could look at the situation, and he could look at the people, and he could say, it's your fault. It was their fault. Every day that he spent from then on, it could have been consumed in bitterness. And yet, there is something about Moses' spirit that comes through in this psalm. It's very powerful. He doesn't blame the people. He identifies with them. He talks about our sin. He talks about how small we are. He talks about verse 8. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your countenance. And he comes to verse 12, which is really a keynote verse. Teach us to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Just go back to that. Try and put yourselves in Moses' shoes. And here you are. You are condemned, really. In many ways, it's a life sentence for these people. They could describe it in those terms. They have now a life sentence. 40 years, we're going to die here. Moses, you're going to leave people. You leave them in their ramblings. They're going to get up. They're going to move on, guided by the pillar of cloud, of fire and of light, but you're going to lead the people. You're going to be their spiritual a prophet for them, a king over them. You'll be, in a certain sense, a priest for them too, but you will be their leader. But it's really a kind of pointless exercise, isn't it? They're not going anywhere, they're just killing time. They're just waiting for the bodies to drop. And if you were at the point of that 40-year spell, it may not be 40 years because they've already spent a bit of time, it's the remainder of the 40 years, but it might be 38 or something like that. But you've got all that time ahead of you to kill, literally. And somebody says to you, here's a blank bit of paper. Here's a pen. Write down your faults. Write down your prayer to God. What are you going to pray for? What's your request? How do you look on the past? How do you see the situation? This is Moses' thoughts as he faces that 40 years. And it is remarkable. And if you're looking at the headings on the sheet of paper that David has prepared, that is consider the psalmist. Moses, consider Moses. That is his position. Now come to this, check the position. Well, what do I mean by that? Well, in any kind of situation like this, in any kind of military strategy or economic crisis, people would always say, right, let's start from where we are. And in Moses' situation, he's sitting down with fellow elders, and you could say, well, let's start from where we are. Let's see where we are. Let's analyze the position. But he doesn't say that. It's not a case of saying we are here geographically. He begins with God. Lord, You have been our dwelling place in all generations. Now, that is a great perspective on the situation, because it's not seeing it so much merely as getting from Egypt to the promised land. But here I am in no man's land, wandering around now, going nowhere, wasting my time. That is how you would look on it geographically, but he doesn't. He sees himself, Lord, you have been our dwelling place. We belong with you. We are the people of God. You are with us. And that really, he is saying to us, is all that matters. And for all the future, as he looks ahead to it, his longing is that the Lord would be with them. The Lord would appear, his work would appear to your servants, that he would appear and make us glad according to the day. Satisfy us early with your mercy and so on. Return, O Lord, to us. Return in your presence. As a matter of interest, when this word appeared, this incident appeared and happened, a number of the Israelites said, you're right, we shouldn't have doubted, we should believe the Lord, we will go in now. And a number of them rallied the troops and they sought to go into the promised land. And Moses said, don't, it's too late, God will not be with you. And sure enough, the Canaanites came down and attacked them. And they chased them down. And it doesn't say, but there presumably was a slaughter there. But God was not with them in that venture. But God was still with these people. In all their wanderings in the desert, he was with them. The pillar of cloud, the pillar of fire did not leave them. And even though God was angry with them from time to time, the Lord did not leave them. Now for Moses that's important. It wasn't that God brought them out of Egypt and then sometime later is going to pick them up again, but in the meantime leave them to their amblings around. No, Lord, you have been our dwelling place. Checks the position. He thinks on God's character. Character of permanence. We look out on the hills, the mountains, as they did, as all people do. You love a view, look at the mountains, so solid. Well, before the mountains were brought forth, before you had formed the earth and the world, you are God, from everlasting to everlasting. Eternally, you are God. He says, 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it is past, and like a watch in the night. Somebody, a night watchman, puts in his shift, goes on duty, and then 8 hours later or whatever the shift is, he comes off duty. Well, that's like 1,000 years for God. What would Cobham look like 1,000 years ago? I mean, I don't know, I'm not that familiar, but I imagine that all that would be familiar would be the river. There might be a gathering of sorts, but they're only beyond the sight of houses now. I can't think there'd be any building here that would be there then. It would just be the river, probably a different course. Trees are all that you see here, a great grand descendants of trees that would have been there then, but it's different, completely different. All the people that have lived here, all the people have come and gone, people have passed through, people have worked here, labored here, people have lived here, born here, died here. A watch in the night, come and they've gone. God sees all that, and it's just a passing watch in the night. He is eternal. He is powerful. He creates with a word. He calls forth the light, calls forth the mountains, calls forth man, brings them into being, and calls man to destruction. Verse 3, you turn man to destruction and say, return, O children of men, as though he is standing on the border of the Kadesh Barnea, the wilderness of Paran, on the border of the promised land, saying, you go back, you disbelieving Israelites, you rejected me, I reject you, you will not come into this land. He turns them back and he carries them away with a flood. His power can destroy with a word, he can create with a word. Notice too how he sees his perception. You set our iniquities before you, verse 8. Our secret sins in the light of your countenance. Our open sins, our secret sins are all open before him. That is God. What about man? Well, wrapped up in these verses are the corresponding characteristics of man, the eternity of God and yet the frailty of man. 1,000 years in your sight, like yesterday when it is past, like a watch in the night, but you carry them away like a flood. They're like a sleep. And we're going to Linton, and some of you might have been there in North Devon and seen pictures of the flood in 53 or whenever it was, and huge boulders were swept down the valley and just devastated and swept everything before it. You have that picture of the Boxing Day tsunami with the rising tide, and you just see all that flotsam and jets, and just, it wasn't, you think of a tsunami, don't you, and the crashing huge great wave, and it wasn't, it was just a massive sort of uprising sea level, and it just swept everything up. And swept it all away and left it all crumpled and broken. And that's the thought here. Mankind, a generation, is just swept away like a flood. And in another picture, like the grass in the morning, like they are like grass which grows up in the morning, it flourishes and grows up. In the evening, it is cut down and withers. Spurgeon describes the history of grass as sown, grown, mown, blown, gone. And the history of man is not much different, he says. And that is how it is. We are frail, we are soon gone. And you can understand Moses writing this, and it is his thought as he thinks of what is ahead and these years, and the bodies are going to be dropping, the carcasses are going to be falling in the desert. And there's a sorrow here and a sadness. We have been consumed by your anger, and by your wrath we are terrified. You've set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your countenance, for all our days have passed away in your wrath. We finish our years like a sigh. There's sadness there. There's sinfulness there. And you see the huge gap. You see the gap between God's eternity and man's temporary frailty, his shortness of life. You see God's power and greatness. You see man's weakness. You see God's holiness, you see man's sinfulness, you see God's all-seeing eye, that he sees our secret sins, and you see man's blind and willful ignorance and unbelief, and you see the love and joy that are wrapped up in God, and you see the sadness and the hardships and the misery that are wrapped up in man's life. And so Moses comes to verse 12, so teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Well, he's not just talking about working out how long we've got and saying, well, make sure you use your time well. I mean, there is that, and it's helpful, but he's not saying that. He's not asking us to do useful things, stop idling our time away. He's not just saying that. He's saying that we may gain a heart of wisdom, apply it to spiritual things. And this third section, convert it into prayer. He's getting a perspective on these years, the 80 years he's lived, the 40 or so years that he's got as he spends his time in the desert leading these people, what is lying ahead. It is important as we face a new year, isn't it, to get this pilgrimage in perspective and to see where we are. God has been with us. He has kept us. We can see the shortness of life. We can see our frailty. We know we're getting old. We can see things beginning to go wrong and pains and so on. And we know one day it will be our turn. And we know that. But how do we then give ourselves to thinking about how we're going to spend our time? Well, what strikes me, and I haven't really seen this before, is how Moses does this with joy. And he doesn't merely, if I was in his position, and I'm trying to put myself in his position, the best I could come up with is, Lord, help me to keep going. Help me to bear these people. Help me to not be bitter. Help me to make it through. I don't think I could get any higher than that. That's the best I could do. But Moses' prayer is so much further than that. It's sublime. He prays for God's presence. Return, O Lord, how long? Have compassion on your servants. Now, listen to this. Oh, satisfy us early with your mercy, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Isn't that incredible? Everything I've said up to this point really is kind of hard and sorrowful, and it's realistic, isn't it? We think of the hardships in life and all that awaits us, and we don't know what it'll be, but we've got to keep going and so on. But here's Moses in this situation praying, make us glad all our days. He's got these years to come, and he's praying that God would satisfy him early with his mercy. They have tasted his wrath. They've seen that. Moses has had to beseech God for these people, and the Lord has relented and said he will spare them. And now Moses is praying that God would satisfy them with his mercy, that they may rejoice, so that each day they're going to wake up to the same beating sun, the same food, the same faces, the same complaints, the same aches, just the same heartaches. But satisfy us early with your mercy, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days, this day and tomorrow and the day after. For you are with us, you who have been our dwelling place in all generations. Be our dwelling place in the days to come. Be with us and satisfy us with your presence and your mercy, your forgiving power. Isn't that great? But here, Moses identifying with these people, talking about our iniquities and our secret sin, but then saying, satisfy us with your mercy, a merciful, a forgiving, compassionate God. He's not saying that the sentence of the 40 years is going to be remitted or anything like that, but God will keep them. And even though their bodies will fall, God would keep them through that time. And Moses prays, make us glad all our days. And he prays further, make us glad according to the days in which you have afflicted us, and the years in which we have seen evil. Let your work appear to your servants, and your glory to their children, and let the beauty of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish the work of our hands for us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. What was the work of their hands? What was the fruit he's talking about? Well, just in this difficult, unrelenting environment, to be the kind of people that God would have them to be. Very unpromising, very infertile, but may the people of God be the fruitful people. May they show the character of the God who loves them and who keeps them. He's praying that he would establish their work so that there may be wisdom. Teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Moses was a wise man. He had the wisdom of the Egyptians. But he's not talking about that kind of wisdom. He had the wisdom of maturity in old age. But he's not talking about that kind of wisdom either. He's talking about the wisdom that comes from looking at his circumstances and seeing God at work and converting it into prayer. Well, let's, as we face this new year, turn it, the perspective that we have. Voice our anxieties before our Maker. Commit our way to him and pray that his mercy would keep us, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Amen.